Don't frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM, WVUDN, WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on April 1st, 2018, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Rachel and I talk about radical and liberal history in Idaho. Then we talk about voting rights reforms in Washington State and felony disenfranchisement after an incident in Texas. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line this week from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, Bill. Good to be back.
We're going to be talking about continuing the series that we started last week. We had talked about radicalism and the leftism in New England historically. We're moving now to Idaho, which is where Rachel lives, and we're going to be talking about some various sort of populist, radical, unionist, leftist things that happened at various points in Idaho history. Something that we've alluded to previously on the show is this sort of like rich tradition of populism, some good, some bad, in the sort of Mountain West region. I think we've done interviews before on the topic of Montana, and Montana was, for example, a place that had some of the earliest and strongest anti-corruption laws for its state politics after a particularly nasty incident. There's also, like, in the Dakotas, there's a whole history of various sort of populist reforms, good government reforms, even sort of borderline socialist programs. And of course, there's some of that in Idaho as well, which we wanted to talk about. One of the sort of early things within the sort of Idaho before it became a state in 1890 was that Idaho was part of the Grange movement or the Granger movement. That's an organization that still exists today, but the it's still got some members and chapters in Idaho. I looked that up before we started recording. That is something that some people might have heard about in their history class, depending on, you know, what curriculum you had. But basically, that was this farmer-led movement in these rural states, especially out in the West, but not exclusively. I think they also had some in, like, Illinois and New York. And they this is from some stuff from the Wikipedia page, just to like catch people up to speed on that, since we're not going to spend too much time on it. They said the Granger movement supported efforts by politicians to regulate rates charged by the railroads and grain warehouses. It claimed credit for the ideas of the Cooperative Extension Service, rural free delivery of mail, and the Farm Credit System, which was a lending service for farmers. The peak of their political reputation was marked by the Supreme Court decision in Munn v. Illinois, 1877, which held that grain warehouses were a private utility in the public interest and could be regulated by public law. This achievement was overturned later by the Supreme Court in Wabash v. Illinois, 1886. The Grange movement was also pro-temperance, pro-direct election of senators, which is something we'll be talking about later, and women's suffrage, which is also something we'll be talking about later. Many of the state and local Granges adopted nonpartisan political resolutions, especially regarding the regulation of railroad transportation costs. That's sort of the thing they're most famous for, I think. And the organization was unusual at this time because women and any teen old enough to draw a plow were encouraged to participate. The importance of women was reinforced by requiring that four of the elected positions could only be held by women. And again, this was a national organization, which still exists to some degree. There was an article in 2010 about kind of the decline going on in Idaho with some of the membership, especially in the northern part of the state. And the article from the spokesman said, found that after the Civil War, the Grange movement mobilized farmers to advocate for progressive causes such as rural mail delivery and antitrust laws for railroads. Over the years, Granges stayed active in grassroots politics. Granges also became social centers. Activities at the local Grange helped combat the isolation that scattered farm families experienced. So that was something that obviously existed beyond Idaho in many, especially in many of the states surrounding Idaho, but it certainly was one of the early sort of populist and slightly radical forces that existed in places like Idaho early on. But that's just sort of like a general background thing. Now we'll go to 1892, which is 2 years into Idaho's statehood. And Rachel, what is the story that we should start out learning about from Idaho?
Okay, so I found a blog post on the Lawyers, Guns, Money blog. It was just kind of a this day in history. So on July 11th, 1892, striking silver miners in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, blew up the Frisco Mine, a mine building filled with guards. After getting into a firefight with Pinkertons, they killed two mine employees and took about 60 mine guards prisoner. So leading up to this, the mine owners wanted to invest in new machinery, so they wanted to cut costs. And the way they chose to do that was to force their workers to work 10 hours from a previous 9 hours, 7 days a week, and take a pay cut on top of it. In response, the miners decided to strike, and the 3,000 miners demanded not only good wages for themselves, but for the 500 common laborers who also toiled in the mines. So it was definitely a sense of solidarity expressed by the miners in trying to include the common laborers as well. Part of the nefarious part of this story is the story of a Pinkerton agent named Charles Siringo. He managed to gain the trust of the strikers by advancing the men small loans and buying them drinks. And so doing that, he became recording secretary for the union, which gave him access to the union's books. He reported everything back to the mine owners, and he also kind of exaggerated the miners' radicalism. So he had his own hatred for organized labor, and he used that to paint the miners as anarchists and out-of-control, violent men. By early July, Siringo was suspected as a spy when union information began appearing in local newspapers. So this outraged the miners, and they took a more militant stand. So late on the night of July 10th, miners gathered to stop a new trainload of scabs from entering the mines. During the strike, they got miners from Montana, and the miners' union did try to kind of bring the scabs over, but it was obviously difficult to bring the scabs over because they were coming in from Montana by the trainload. So no one knows who shot first, but Pinkertons were far more prepared for the shootout, having hidden behind rocks, whereas the union members were in the open. Nonetheless, the union men climbed above the Frisco Mill and dropped a box of powder down a flume, which exploded upon impact, killing one mine employee. The Pinkertons ran out and hid in another building. The miners fired into the building, killing another Pinkerton and forcing the Pinkertons to surrender. So overall, three mines fell into the hands of the workers by the evening of July 11th. And then this led the Idaho governor, N.B. Willie, to declare martial law and send in the Idaho National Guard to break the union. Siringo identified the union leaders for arrest, and the National Guard rounded up the miners, locking them in a bullpen, and martial law continued for 4 months. So one of the huge impacts of this mine strike was the creation of the Western Federation of Miners the next year. So Big Bill Haywood, a very famous union leader, declared that the Western Federation of Miners was born in the Boise prisons where the Coeur d'Alene miners served their prison sentences. The Western Federation of Mines became a force in the Western mines during the 1890s and 1900s, and it played the most important role in creating the Industrial Workers of the World in 1905. You kind of talked about the history of the Wobblies last week on your New England show. They became a huge union force in the 1890s and 1900s, and I think they were most nefarious and infamous for the bombing of Frank Stunenberg. Frank Stunenberg was a former governor of Idaho. He actually was bombed and killed in my hometown of Caldwell. There's a little plaque in downtown Caldwell that kind of commemorates the site of the bombing. It's a fairly interesting piece of local history from my hometown. So nearly 5 years after he left office, Stunenberg was killed outside his house at 1602 Dearborn Street in Caldwell by a bomb rigged to the side gate. Harry Orchard, who was a former miner from the Western Federation of Miners, was arrested in Caldwell shortly after the assassination, and the investigation was conducted by Pinkerton agent James McParland. First, Orchard pled innocent, but after solitary confinement and intense interrogation by McParland, who knows what that means, Orchard signed a 64-page typewritten confession detailing years of being a paid assassin and dynamiter for the Western Federation of Miners. And so he claimed he was hired to kill Stunenberg by the leadership, and he had been in previous jobs that resulted in at least 17 other deaths. So Orchard said his orders came directly from Big Bill Haywood, Charles Moyer, president of the WFM, and George Pettibone, a labor activist who had a prior conviction related to the 1892 labor dispute in Coeur d'Alene. At McParland's urging, the three were arrested in Denver in February 1908 and extradited to Idaho for the trial. This was a huge national publicized trial. It took place in Boise over several months in mid-1907, and it included the new U.S. Senator William Borah for the prosecution and famous lawyer Clarence Darrow for the defense. So on the witness stand, Orchard repeated his written confession, admitting to years of setting bombs for the WFM. He was then cross-examined by the defense for 26 hours spread out over a week's time. In addition to Orchard, the prosecution presented 80 more witnesses to corroborate Orchard's description of numerous attacks. Darrow and the defense team called over 100 witnesses of their own. Closing arguments lasted 2 weeks, the most talked about of which was by Darrow. While in the modern day, commentators have praised Darrow's closing argument, it was very, very negatively received at the time because he used powerful emotional rhetoric focused on the moral superiority of the Union's position. The Chicago Tribune called it the most unseemly, abusive, inflammatory speech ever delivered in an American courtroom. So despite the wildly negative opinion for the Union, the verdict was an acquittal for Haywood in late July. Pettibone was defended in a separate trial and was also acquitted, and charges were dropped against Moyer because he was dying of pancreatic cancer. Orchard was the only one who received a sentence for this crime. He received a death sentence, but the sentence was commuted to life in prison. And in 1952, at 86 years of age and 45 years after the trial, he wrote in his autobiography that all of his confession and his trial testimony were true. So we've had kind of a violent leftist history, I would say. Probably a bit more violent than New England, just because that we had kind of the rough and ready miners, and they were heavily male. Like you mentioned last week, in New England, there was a lot of like organization by women in the factories.
Or families, like the immigrant families and stuff, was probably a little more stable some of the time. I mean, there definitely was some violence in New England as well.
yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Also, I like the Chicago Tribune really jumping the gun by several years on their claim about the most inflammatory speech ever delivered in an American courtroom by Clarence Darrow. And this is 1907. And then in 1925, he like completely tops it during the Scopes Monkey trial.
Yep.
That must have driven them completely nuts.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to see like these figures pop up over and over again. Like, Clarence Darrow, obviously, very, very famous for his performance in the courtroom. So, yeah, it's kind of interesting to see that.
Now, yeah. You started by talking about this Coeur d'Alene strike in 1892, and then you were talking about some of the things that developed out of that and, like, you know, continued for several years. But let's jump back to 1892 now, if you don't mind. Okay. So this was kind of happening in, like, the middle of the year, like July or so. What happens in, like, November, December in 1892 with the presidential election that year?
Yeah, so... in Idaho, we kind of embraced the populist party platform, which was all about pro-worker protection. So, let's see, condemnation of the Pinkerton system, an 8-hour day, secret ballot, the initiative and referendum, and direct election of senators. So, they also demanded an arbitration board to settle industrial disputes. And an investigation of the 1892 mining war in Idaho. The Populist Party in Idaho were kind of gunning for that. They also objected to appropriations for the state militia, charging that it was simply a tool used by the state and the mine owners to suppress labor. Unfortunately, they kind of fed into kind of a racist animosity. They also called for legislation to forbid employment of aliens, unfortunately. But they also called to outlaw yellow dog contracts where workers agreed not to enter a union or if they are a part of a union to withdraw from the union. They also prohibited company stores. They wanted to abolish blacklisting. One of the most dramatic speeches in the legislature during this period was the one against blacklisting delivered by Edward Boyce, populist state senator from Shoshone County, and one of the union leaders who had been sentenced to the Ada County Jail in 1892 for his sympathetic leanings towards the miners in the Frisco mine explosion.
And that also, I think, like, some of this populist party stuff, you know, you mentioned the things about, like, the condemnation of the Pinkerton system, which is obviously related to the, you know, these industrial workers, but... There were also those elements that clearly come out of the Granger movement, like the... you know, the government ownership of the railroad, telephone, and telegraph facilities, like, that's clearly sort of an extension beyond what the Grangers were pushing, but in the similar vein, targeting similar sort of utilities and services and infrastructure. And, you know, then, as you mentioned, there are the other things that are just, like, the regulations, labor regulations, like 8-hour day, et cetera. But then you can also see a lot of these things like, you know, initiative and referendum system, direct election of senators, things like that. These are things that become or already were at that point starting to be like a key part of the progressive era movement, pushing a lot of constitutional reforms in many states.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they also called for a flexible federal currency, free and unlimited coinage of silver, a graduated income tax, in addition to all those other things. And they actually, it seems like they were most popular in these Mountain West states. So our first three electoral college votes for president all went to populist or Democratic populist candidates. So first we in 1892, we went for James B. Weaver, the populist candidate from Iowa, who only really got votes from like the Dakotas, Colorado, Kansas. And then in the next two elections, our votes went to William Jennings Bryan, who was a Democratic populist candidate of those elections. So we've kind of had a long history of bucking the system, I guess.
Now, as I alluded to at the beginning, we said we were going to talk a little bit more about direct election of senators and women's suffrage. So partly as evidenced by this populist push and also from, you know, as an outgrowth of the Granger stuff and nearby Wyoming setting an example as well. Can you talk a little bit about that and how Idaho was ahead of the curve compared to the federal government?
So Idaho enacted women's suffrage in November of 1896. We were the fourth state to do so after Wyoming and Utah. So it was definitely a push from the West. I think women were seen as like a moderating, temperate force to kind of put, balance out these kind of rough anarchists. miners and stuff. So I think it was seen as like the women will kind of be the cooler heads to maybe prevail.
And the they were also pushing for the so that ends up being the 19th Amendment, basically, mm-hmm. that, you know, that's passed in 1920, I think. Mm-hmm. But also direct election of senators was something that was being supported by, you know, populists in places like Idaho. Mm-hmm. But it ends up not happening until at the federal level until 1913.
Yeah, I think it's part of that more direct democratic representation that the populists were going for. Definitely direct election of senators ties into that very much, along with those like initiative and referendum movements as well.
Sort of interesting though too, you mentioned about in that big trial where they were, you know, it's this national publicized trial where they're essentially trying to disrupt and dismantle the IWW in its sort of nascent stage after 1905. And you mentioned that, obviously we talked about earlier about Clarence Darrow being for the defense, but you also had, you said Senator Borah for the prosecution, which is sort of a bizarre situation, I guess. I don't know how that must have used to happen a lot more than it would today, but like this was before the direct election of senators. So this would have been like the state legislature would have picked this guy to be mm-hmm. their senator. And then I guess before he trundled off to D.C., he stuck around to try to throw some miners in prison forever and break up the IWW and all that.
Yeah, it seems like the people in power in Boise were kind of against the populist movement. Like I said, they threw that state senator in jail for his sympathetic leanings. And so I think that sending Borah to the Senate was a clear message that the people in power were very anti-worker, anti-union.
So obviously, like, there's kind of a mixed bag early on because we did have, you know, they were voting for the populists for president. They were electing these populist state senators and state reps. So there was some representation. But as you said, the sort of like the governors and that and those type of people seem to be pretty anti-worker and anti-union a lot of the time. But let's jump forward in history to one of Idaho's most popular statewide elected officials, Frank Church, and talk about how, you know, he was sort of this really popular figure who was a lot more in the other direction on a lot of issues.
Mm-hmm. So I think Frank Church is best known for his role in the Church Committee, obviously, kind of shining a light on the surveillance apparatus that has been in place for decades. He was kind of known as a dove. Although he initially supported the Vietnam War, he was one of the first to kind of change and switch his position and speak out against the Vietnam War. He was in office from January 3rd, 1957 to January 3rd, 1981. So he is definitely one of the longest senators in office from Idaho. And also he was also very wildly popular. Obviously, because he won so many terms. Oh, and he also led the effort to ratify the Torrijos-Carter treaties, which returned the Panama Canal Zone to Panama. So he's definitely more of a dove against meddling in other countries. And also, he was also known as a conservationist. He sponsored the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. And also, in 1964, he was the floor sponsor of the National Wilderness Act. So working with members of Congress from northwestern states, he helped establish the Hell's Canyon National Recreation Area along the Oregon-Idaho border, which protected the Hell's Canyon Gorge from dam building. And he was also the primary proponent in the establishment of the Sawtooth Wilderness and National Recreation Area in central Idaho in 1972. He was also instrumental in the creation of Idaho's River of No Return Wilderness Area in 1980. So it was 2.36 million acres. It's the largest wilderness area in the nation outside of Alaska. And it later was renamed the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness Area in 1984, shortly before he died. So I think he was wildly popular because of these conservation efforts, and because he was so anti-war and anti the military intelligence apparatus. Like, he definitely shone a light on a lot of things. Like, in late 1975 and early 1976, a subcommittee of the U.S. Senate led by Church concluded that members of the Lockheed board had paid members of friendly governments to guarantee contracts for military aircraft in a series of illegal bribes and contributions made by Lockheed officials from the late 1950s to the 1970s. In 1976, it was publicly revealed that Lockheed had paid $22 million in bribes to foreign officials in the process of negotiating the sale of aircraft, including the F-104 Starfighter, the so-called deal of the century. I think by embracing these progressive movements and these anti-war sentiments, I think he's known as one of the best senators that Idaho has ever had, definitely. And one of the best in the nation, I believe.
Let's talk now about Cecil Andrus, who was the governor of Idaho from 1971 to 1977, and then again from 1987 to 1995. He also had some interesting progressive positions as well, and also then served as the U.S. Secretary of the Interior in that interim period there from 1977 to 1977 to 1981 under Jimmy Carter. Tell us a little bit about Cecil Andrus.
So he initially ran for governor in 1966, but he was narrowly defeated in the Democratic primary by Charles Herndon, who was an attorney. However, 7 weeks before the November election, Herndon and two others died in a twin-engine private plane crash in the mountains northwest of Stanley, Idaho, which is kind of in that sawtooth salmon wilderness area. So Andrus was then appointed the nominee to take Herndon's place on the ballot, but he lost that general election to Republican Don Samuelson by more than 11,000 votes, earning him the unlikely distinction of losing both the primary and general election races for the same office in the same year. So then Andrus returned to the state Senate, but he then defeated Samuelson in the next election by over 10,000 votes. This was attributed in large part to Andrus's public opposition to proposals for development of molybdenum mining in central Idaho's White Cloud Mountains, which Samuelson supported. So he also had a very conservationist bent. In his first term, he played a key role in winning support by the U.S. Congress for federal designation of the Sawtooth Wilderness Area in the state of Idaho. And he was easily reelected in 1974 with over 70% of the vote, which was a record margin. However, in 1977, he left that governor position to serve as Secretary of the Interior for Jimmy Carter. He took a leadership role in securing congressional passage of the Redwood National Park Expansion Act in 1978, which added 48,000 acres to Redwood National Park in California, which helped preserve the giant redwood forest there. And then after that term, he went back and ran for governor again in 1987. He did live several years in the private sphere, but then he chose to throw his hat back in the ring, and he defeated Governor David H. Leroy. And during this stint, he vigorously opposed federal efforts to store nuclear waste in Idaho, and he also brokered a pathbreaking agreement among land use and conservation interests to control water pollution from non-point sources to protect riparian and fish habitat in Idaho's rivers and streams. And then in his fourth and final term as governor, he was again in the national spotlight due to the Endangered Species Act listing of several Snake River salmon species. So he called attention to the downstream federal dams operated by the Army Corps of Engineers as the major culprit in the reduction of these salmon species numbers. His successful lawsuit against the federal government led to incremental changes in operations of the dams and to continuing efforts for major conservationist modifications to the dams that are ongoing today. So he was also wildly popular, didn't really hide his progressive leanings at all. And he did die in August of last year, and he was positively eulogized by every politician that ever met him, both Democrat and Republican. So I think having these progressive conservationist views is kind of a way to get bipartisan support and to be so popular in Idaho, because we are such a rural state. We're such a state where there's a lot of opportunity for outdoor recreation in our wilderness areas. So I think that's definitely a lesson that Democratic progressive candidates can take today, really emphasize these conservationist positions and emphasize how important they are for both Democrats and Republicans, because hunters and fishers need land to hunt fish on, as well as people who just like to hike and enjoy the great outdoors and be in nature.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for us on our Idaho segment, talking about some progressive and leftist and radical history elements in Idaho. We also want to invite people to send us their ideas. If there's some like story from your part of the country, we're probably going to do Delaware next, but if there's some story from your part of the country that you want to talk about, some interesting radical history or something you think is overlooked or not that well known outside of your state or your region, you can send it to us at afdradio@gmail.com or tweet it at us, afdradio. And we'll take a look at that and consider including it in the show. A lot of the stuff for today's segment are things that you can read more about on Wikipedia, because we're looking at a lot of the Wikipedia pages for some of this. Also, if you missed last week's episode, there's a lot of great stuff with articles linked on the website at arsenalfordemocracy.com, various articles and research about those New England stories. We'll have information on this stuff up as well for this week up at arsenalfordemocracy.com. If you'll stick around, we'll be back in just a moment. We're going to be talking about Washington State's recent voting reforms. So stay tuned. Democracy. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still on the line with me is Rachel. Rachel, your sister, Sarah, former guest on the show, suggested that we talk about the neighboring state of Washington, and specifically their recent round of very exciting voting reforms in that state, because, as she argued, it's a lot of the stuff that we had called for on the show for the federal level and various states to pass, and Washington actually did something on it. So this has been happening over basically the month of March. If you look back a couple years, 2016, 2014 even, you'll see a lot of articles about like how they were really struggling to pass voting reforms in Washington state. This had been something that like the Democrats were really trying to do, but the Republicans very narrowly controlled the state Senate there. Until, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, Washington was still like a, you know, swingy state, purple state, even arguably a Republican state in some cases. But it is pretty solidly Democratic now, but they only just got control of the state Senate. I think last year, if I remember correctly, I could be wrong on some of the details there, but I think like someone got a minor appointment in the Trump administration and tried to be like, oh, I'm going to be in the Trump administration and also being a state senator on the other side of the country at the same time. And I think they eventually were like, no, you can't do that. But anyway, the situation is such that they have a very, 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 very narrow majority for the Democrats finally in the state Senate, and they have the House under Democratic control, and they also have a Democratic governor, and so they decided to pass a bunch of reforms. Democratic governor there, being a real drama queen, is quoted in the Seattle Weekly at his signing statement of, "The course of democracy makes the sweetest music when it swells with the most voices." Not how I would have written that line, but it makes the point, right? That the whole point of having this democracy is to try to get more people able to participate, right? So what are some of the reforms that jump out at you, Rachel, as being particularly interesting? There were a whole bunch that got passed.
Yeah, the HB 1513 was the one that stood out to me the most. It allows 16 and 17 year olds to pre-register to vote beginning on July 1st, 2019, even if at the next election they won't be 18 at that time. So that is one thing that Idaho doesn't have. Idaho kind of has some fairly lax requirements for registration. That one definitely jumps out at me, because that is something that we still do not have. I think you can register when you're 17 as long as you will be 18. And I think you can even vote in the primary at 17. as long as you're 18 for the general election. So I think that is something that, Idaho could definitely work on.
Yeah, we do have that in Massachusetts, and there have been some efforts to try to get like kids to register, pre-register to vote, you know, so that they can vote whenever they do turn 18. I don't necessarily know. I don't know if there's a lot of data yet at this point, because there's a dozen or so states that have this now. I don't know what the data is on, like, what the impact of that is. But presumably, assuming they don't move, which is not necessarily the case for a lot of populations, if they don't move during that interval, then they don't have to worry about it. They just show up to vote. You know, there's no question of did they get registered in time, that sort of thing, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and another one that jumped out at me is SB 5991, which requires that nonprofits file statements with the Public Disclosure Commission if they make contributions or expenditures above $10,000 on political campaigns in a calendar year, and that begins January 1st, 2019. So I think that is definitely a super important thing to just create transparency in campaign contributions. And having such a low bar too. I think 10,000 in a calendar year is actually pretty easy for some of the bigger nonprofits to overcome. So I think having such a low threshold is definitely important as well.
Yeah, because there's definitely been that issue of nonprofits sort of bending and skirting various rules at the federal level, especially, but also at the state level of like masking various donations, especially toward like issue campaigns is often where you see that, I think. I wonder how they settled on that 10,000, though. That's something I'd be curious to know more about. I didn't see anything in these articles from the Seattle Weekly or the Brennan Center talking about that, unless I missed it. But like 10,000, I don't know. I can envision like some entrepreneurial shady, you know, multimillionaire guy like setting up, you know, 10 different nonprofits so that they could each donate $9,000 and not have to report. Yeah. So I am curious as to know, you know, where did they come up with the $10,000 threshold? But that's certainly going in the right direction, probably. There were some other key reforms that they also passed in Washington as part of this package. So there was SB 6002, designed to increase minority representation by allowing cities, counties, and school districts to shift from citywide to district elections starting in 2018. Don't know like whether they're talking about just specifically like school board type elections when they refer to district elections, or if they're talking about some other form of like elections there. That's a little unclear to me. But you know, sometimes that can be a problem where you have like you're isolated in your city and kind of like it's separated from everything else that's going on. The minority representation aspect, I think, reflects the fact that there is a lot of segregation in this country and probably in Washington state as well, like self-segregation, sometimes just de facto, sometimes in, you know, pushed by the banks and sometimes by the real estate industry, et cetera. However, whatever the source may be, like, hopefully this is to try to like break them out from each other. I also like, there's a lot of tendency in certain parts of the country to like schedule a lot of local elections, like off cycle and everything, like completely not in aligned with other elections. And that tends to decrease participation and representation from a lot of folks. Like it ends up being really, really only hardcore voters that show up to vote in those elections, because it's hard to even keep track of when they are. Automatic voter registration obviously is a big one that we've talked about before. So that would be separate from the pre-registration for people younger than 18. But if you are 18 years or older, if you apply for or renew a driver's license, you would have to opt out from being registered to vote. Now, I believe that we've talked about previously on the show, the state of Oregon, right next door to Washington, had already done this opt-out system, and they got a lot more people. They also didn't just use driver's licenses. I think they used other things, various like welfare and Medicaid and that type of thing, if I remember correctly, to try to find people. But in Washington, it's based on the driver's license, and most people do have that. And it says residents who are eligible to vote will also be able to do so when they enroll in the state's health insurance exchange. So that is, you know, similar to like probably also applies to Medicaid. But it doesn't specify that exactly here. And so it's an interesting set of reforms. The Brennan Center for Justice at NYU also has some articles. Some of it was written before some of these had actually passed or been signed. But they cite that there's, 42 state legislatures in session right now, and this is like when we should take this momentum and go past stuff. But of course, the vast majority of these legislatures are controlled by Republicans in many states, so we're not really expecting them to be expanding the franchise and that sort of thing, although there are various Democratic states that are considering some of these things. I think as a Massachusetts person, like, the most frustrating thing to me is that we have 80% supermajorities in our legislature. We have veto-proof supermajorities. We could just ignore the governor and pass whatever, and they're basically not doing it, and we only just got the Secretary of State to endorse it. That's a Democratic longtime office holder who was really holding out against automatic voter registration, same-day registration, and various other measures. Even though, like, we also did some early voting measures that we tested, like, last time in 2016, and those were wildly popular, and they're going to increase the funding for it. And it's like, people would like this in Massachusetts. We would like to make the voting easier and the participation easier, and they're not going along with it. And it's like, why is it so hard to do this in Massachusetts when we have these 80% supermajorities? And you look at Washington, and the only difference they can point to is, well, the governor's a Democrat in Washington and not in Massachusetts. And it's like, but again, they have like a one-seat majority right now in the legislature, or one of the chambers of the legislature in Washington, and they still did this. Like, why is it that the Democratic majorities in Massachusetts have to be pushed so hard on just even basic stuff that can only help them with getting more people to vote for the Democrats, like, in a really Democratic state like Massachusetts? The whole thing doesn't make any sense. I mean, you can get really conspiratorial about their various reasons or whatever, but it's frustrating to have this happen in Massachusetts. Obviously, I think a little bit of a different situation in Idaho, although, as you alluded to earlier, Rachel, like, Idaho is surprisingly not as restrictive on certain things as you might expect from such a Republican-dominated state government.
Yeah, as I've pointed out before, we do have election day registration or update to your registration. So that is definitely something that kind of puts us ahead of other states, for sure. And I think we definitely have room to move. So if we do enact this automatic voter registration, I think that would be a great thing to do. I know Washington does voting by mail. So I think reducing that barrier to getting to your polling place. I believe the postage is paid for basically by the election commission. So it's just as easy as filling out your ballot and dropping it in a mailbox. So I think that is definitely a step that I think Idaho should go towards. I believe voting has gone up amazingly ever since they've done that. So we do also have no excuse absentee polling, but I think that should be something we can look at for the future.
The other big story related to voting that's been going around in the past week or so is this story from Texas, where a woman was sentenced to 5 years in prison for accidentally voting illegally in the election. In the November 8th, 2016 election, Crystal Mason in Dallas, her mom told her, hey, you have to go vote. And so she went to go vote. She didn't see her name on the voting roll, and she was kind of confused by that. But she was given a provisional ballot was one of the last few people to vote or whatever. She used all of her proper paperwork, her current license, current address, everything, cast this provisional ballot. And, you know, then the question is, like, it's a provisional ballot, right? So aren't they not supposed to count it if they find out that you weren't supposed to be able to vote? Like, don't they just, like, it's, isn't it marked differently? And you should be able to say, okay, it's not a valid ballot. I guess maybe they can't track the specific person or whatever. I don't know. In Massachusetts, with this early voting thing, they did an interesting thing, which I think is a bit risky given the secret ballot implications, but the early voting, basically, in order to track who had already voted carefully, they made you put it in an envelope that was marked with your, like, name and identifying information. So I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I guess it would have prevented this situation here. But like, they must do it something like that, or else what's the definition of a provisional ballot? But anyway, in February 2017, she was detained by sheriffs at the while meeting with a probation officer because it turns out that she is a convicted felon. She had previously been convicted for committing tax fraud for clients through her tax prep business. I'm reading for the NPR story on this, but it says, by casting a ballot, even a provisional one, in the general election, she had broken a state law that prohibited residents from voting until their sentences have been fully served. That includes parole, probation, or supervision. She had been on supervised release after spending 3 years in prison, and she was even working for the state of Texas at one point. And so I guess in Texas, like, they don't have the thing where you can't vote forever because of a conviction. But they do have a thing where if you're still on probation or, you know, parole or whatever, then you can't vote because you're still technically like an active convict or something. But anyway, they basically she tried to vote because she thought she could vote, tried to cast the provisional ballot. She was never informed of the voting restrictions on felons. And she's saying that her attorney is saying that she was never told she couldn't vote. Like, a judge, a halfway house, a probation officer, nobody actually told her this. And the DA there, who, you know, is seeking this 5-year prison sentence for her for accidentally voting, is saying there were multiple safeguards in place and she still made that choice. She signed and affirmed a document which clearly stated that she was prohibited from voting due to her status as a convicted felon serving the term of her supervision, and that she'd be committing a second degree felony if she lied about that status. So basically, like, the argument here is like that she went, you know, she hurried over to her polling precinct, couldn't find her name. They shoved a piece of paper at her and told her to sign something so she could vote before they closed up. And she signed it without reading it, like not reading the terms of service. And like, I don't know, like, I mean, there's, you know, are you supposed to stand there and read through the whole thing? Like, yeah, legally speaking, yes, but I don't know that that's necessarily actually the safeguard that they're implying that it's supposed to be. And there's also various people are talking about, like, there was someone who, like, was a pro-Trump person who was, like, convinced that the election was rigged with millions of illegal Democrat votes against Trump, so she intentionally voted illegally twice for Trump, and like she got like a suspended 2-year sentence or something like that, and they're being like, just, well, toss this woman back in prison for 5 years because she accidentally voted. I mean, it's such a like minor crime, and they're just so like fanatical about trying to find this supposed massive fraud being perpetrated that they're just like have to make an example of her because she's a black woman, and the other woman who got this suspended sentence, of course, is white. Rachel, what did you think of this story?
Yeah, I think people pointed out on Twitter, because it was a provisional ballot, I think they only count those if the race is too close to call. So I doubt her ballot was ever even counted. So the fact that they're pursuing this so rabidly is really appalling to me. And it obviously, it definitely shows that there's a racial component, especially given that the stark contrast with the white woman who voted because she was convinced that she had to save Trump, I guess. I think because it was probably not even a successful vote, quote unquote, I don't see the reason. I'm guessing they're using it as an example, making an example of her, but I don't think that it's a widely applicable situation. Like, how many people are in this space not sure if they're eligible to vote or not because nobody ever told them? I don't think the number is as large and widespread as people want to make it out to be. So I know they have to trumpet any instances of voter fraud just because it is so rare and because they are using it as a reason to disenfranchise people. So I understand why they're doing it. It's just, I don't think it's going to be a successful example of voter fraud because it probably was never even counted in the first place.
I think the other thing, too, that's so frustrating about this is like that it varies so much by state. Like, there, especially the fact that we're talking about federal elections, there should just be one federal standard for how we deal with this. Now, I think that people should be able to vote even while they are in prison, there are very few states where that's allowed. I think maybe like Maine and Vermont, I think maybe are the ones that you can actually vote in prison. And of course, those people are being counted for the moment, at least. That's another topic is the census issue. But for the moment, those people, if they're in prison, they're being counted at, you know, in the district where they're in prison, I think. You know, there needs to be like one federal standard, because the fact that like, you know, in Texas, or Louisiana, say like it ends after probation, but then you go like one more state over, you get to, you know, Alabama and Mississippi, like, well, that's circumstantial as to whether or not it ends at all. You go then one state further over, Florida. Okay. Well, now it's like individual petitions required to get, you know, your right to vote back. There's this crazy map on the Wikipedia article for felony disenfranchisement where it's just like a color palette, basically, of like all the different rules. They have unrestricted, ends after release, ends after parole, ends after probation, circumstantial, individual petitions required. And there's no consistency at all. Like, there's one system in Colorado, there's one system in Utah, there's one system in New Mexico, there's one system in Arizona, and that's just the four corner states by themselves that are all next to each other. They, all four of them, have a different law in place regarding felony disenfranchisement or enfranchisement. Like, it's completely bonkers, and it should not have even been allowed at all, but the problem is, so they were like, they kind of did some poor writing of the 14th Amendment, and they said that you could, you know, lose your right to vote or whatever for, quote, for participation in rebellion or other crime. And they were thinking of denying the right to vote from all these Confederates that had, you know, participated in a rebellion against the United States. And of course, all of the Southern states and other states governed by like racist reactionaries or whatever were like, oh, so you mean we can just take away people's right to vote for if they're convicted of any crime whatsoever? Like, that's completely, I mean, that's not really what the intention was. Some people would argue that was what the intention was, and maybe it was. But, the, you know, it certainly, the level of crime they were talking about there was more on the level of, like, rebellion against the United States. It's spun wildly out of control. And I think that more states need to be pushing like felony reenfranchisement. And I think there's no particular reason to not let people vote when they're in prison. Like, there really is not a strong argument for that. Like, what is the reason that you think those people shouldn't be able to vote? Is it just the punishment? Probably that's not why. Anyway, all right, that's going to bring us to the end this week. Rachel, thank you so much for being here on the line to talk about all these issues.
Thanks, Bill. It's always a pleasure.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on ArsenalForDemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.